I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 3:16 on February 24th. Members present are Representatives Carrick, Colomb, Burke, Fields, Paul, and Sadler. Thank you to Nicole Bearden and Zach Lawhorn for tech support. The first order of business today is a presentation called Private Equity in Healthcare. We have several invited testifiers, and as we consider healthcare legislation, thought there'd be some value in just understanding some of the economic landscape our providers are facing, and Representative Nelson's here as well. So first up for invited testimony is Dr. Steve Compton, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. Dr. Compton, thanks for being here today, and please go ahead and begin with your testimony.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Perfect. Well, Steve Compton, I'm a cardiac electrophysiologist at the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. I'm the immediate past president of Alaska Heart, a recent past president of Alaska State Medical Association, wanted to share our experience with private equity regarding medicine. As you know, more and more physicians around the country are employed. And in my field, in cardiology, we've gone from something like 10% employment when I started up to over 90% employment. And we have the fortune, I think, of being a privately held group. Just we have a group with about 30 partners now, but we have an advantage of being able to run our own show and structure the practice the way we think is best. And so what I wanted to share with you is an experience we had about 8 or 9 years ago. We were approached by Bain Capital. It's a private equity company. they'd been running around the country doing exactly this. And they approached our group, and I'll share with you what we learned. And in the end, we chose not to pursue this. And since that initial kind of bite and discussion, we've had nonstop nibbles and approaches from all these other groups, but we've made a fundamental decision not to do it. So what I'll share with you is just what we were offered and what the proposal was and what we've learned from colleagues in the lower 48 who have proceeded with this sort of thing. Bain, basically their idea is, hey, you guys, at some level, medicine is a business. There's a profit to be made, and we're the business guys. We all have MBAs, and we know how to turn profits and improve profitability. And instead of measuring success in terms of patient outcomes and survival and quality of care and keeping costs low, what they were proposing is to measure success with an entirely different metric. And this is an accounting term called, it's EBITDA, E-B-I-T-D-A, and I imagine most of you are familiar with this, but it's earnings before income tax, depreciation, and amortization, but fundamentally it's profit. And they say, okay, what we'll do is we would buy your practice, but you would be active partners, though we would control it. And so we would measure your EBITDA, measure your profit, and then we would spend a couple years intervening and helping you identify ways to increase profit. And then at the end of 2 to 4 years, once we're satisfied that we've increased your EBITDA, well, then we'll sell you to another bigger group. And that's how we make our money. But in exchange for what really was a sizable pile of cash, what they wanted us to do was give up clinical control of our practice. And when we asked specifically, well, what exactly would you be changing? And of course, the venture capital or private equity people are not constrained by ethics, and they're not constrained by quality. And so they're what they wanted to do is just change the entire focus of our practice to profit. And in medicine, there are all kinds of opportunities to just absolutely take advantage of patients. And you could, if you wanted, you could just test the heck out of people and get echocardiograms four times a year in certain situations, and just turn these patients to drain whatever they're willing to spend or their insurance companies are willing to spend on their cardiovascular care. And so the fundamentals for their business plan involved really churning patients through, increasing what we thought was unnecessary and inappropriate testing, dropping more and more of the work to lower trained mid-level providers, and ignoring things like survival and quality metrics, so the money that was offered was frankly astonishing. And there were what they called two bites of the apple. One was when they bought us, and one was when they sold us. And but what they made clear was, well, no matter what, you know, once you sell your practice to us, we'll control it for a while, but then it'll be some other people that you don't even know yet, whoever we can persuade to sell your practice to. And we just didn't want to do any of that. And so it was, I think it was a useful exercise for our group to just look at, well, what exactly does that mean? And but in the end, we wanted to be able to look our patients in the eye, look ourselves in the mirror, and feel confident that we were offering patients the best value for their dollar and the best possible care. And so when we talked to colleagues in Lower 48 whose practices have been bought out and are now being run by private equity outfits, I have not met a single physician who's happy with how that's played out. But so anyway, there are plenty of other docs who can tell you what it's like to work under a private equity situation. Our group philosophically was opposed to this whole idea, and we made a solid group decision after extensive discussion with the Bain people. But it's funny, you know, the pressure never goes away. We're constantly being asked to consider yet another private equity group or a venture capital group, and there are all kinds of people approaching us. And we're happy with working for ourselves. We think this is we can offer better care this way. My concern in Alaska, though, frankly, is that now that the 80th percentile rule has been dropped by the Division of Insurance, contracts are being renegotiated, and there are more and more practices that won't be able to keep their lights on, and we see people moving, leaving the state. You can imagine if you were super desperate, and you wanted to stay in Alaska, you could see where people would feel compelled to reach for that branch. And so I think it's kind of a tenuous time for medicine in Alaska. Our group made a very solid decision not to pursue private equity, but we see it as an insidious force. And fundamentally, a medical system that is driven entirely by profit motive, I don't think works in the patient's best interest.
Thank you, Dr. Compton. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Dr. Compton, I'm wondering, do you have a sense of how prolific this is in Alaska, or maybe compare it to outside somewhere?
Well, again, over 90% of the cardiology practices in the country are either held by groups like this or owned by hospital chains. And no one seems to be particularly happy about it. We're busy practicing medicine, and frankly, we're not running around asking all of our non-cardiology colleagues, you know, how their business is going all the time. And so I can't say I have that my ear to the ground on all of that and who's being approached. And frankly, when you're being approached by a private equity group, there's some secrecy involved until things are signed. And so it's not as though people really advertise this until there's a done deal and a signed contract.
Thank you.
Just a couple of anecdotal examples for Representative Hall. So I first ran into this when our pediatricians got bought out by some outside investors and our doctor quit because she said these investors are going to refuse to be invested in the health of children and are going to work to maximize profits from children. So she left the practice and so did we. That was in Anchorage, and then not a private equity firm but an outside investor bought out the Peace Health facility in Ketchikan and left doctors without payment for months. So we don't have a doctor from Ketchikan to testify today, but this has been unfortunately happening in Alaska. Do members have further questions for Dr. Compton? Thank you again, Dr. Compton, for being here and educating us about what you're seeing in the field. Oh, Representative Sadler has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Compton, couldn't let this book go by through the chair without a question or two. What makes, you said that 90% of the cardiology practices are owned by outside chains or private capital. What is it about the practice of cardiology that makes it an attractive target for such business activity?
There's some weird stuff, and it has to do, it's political, and it has to do with lobbying, and the physicians are generally busy doing medicine. I mean, the hours are long, and it's, We're trained in medicine. We're not trained in business. And then the hospital folks, well, they have plenty of time to lobby, and they're better at it than we are. And so at the federal level, I guess a great example is that 20 years ago, if you had a private practice in cardiology, well, part of the profit to keep the lights on was just that there is some profit in imaging. So a classic thing is an echocardiogram, and it's an ultrasound of your heart. There are a lot of measurements and a lot of careful interpretation to be done, and so that's something you can do in your office. And so the federal Medicare payment rules for that changed about 15 years ago now, to where the same exact study, if it's performed in a hospital, it reimburses it somewhere between 6 and 8 times a higher rate for the exact same study compared to a clinic-based study. And so so what that meant is that most echoes were moved to the hospital, and then the hospitals started employing all these physicians who couldn't keep the lights on at home.
Follow up, Representative.
And so you know, there are some differences from specialty to specialty, but I think the bottom line is that physicians aren't businessmen. We're not trained in that, and the hardest part of medicine is just keeping things running. You know, our practice, we've got 300 employees. It's a big outfit, and just staying on top of that is a challenge, and it's something that we're not trained in. Thankfully, we have excellent administrative help, and so we're doing okay. But the smaller your practice, the more vulnerable you are to being snatched up.
And my follow-up, many questions, but I guess through the chair, Dr. Compton, actually John Finley's my guy, so good on you, but can you explain for those who don't know it and for those who need a refresher what the impact of the 80% rule is? What are you speaking of, and how does it affect your practice?
Well, there are two parts to it. Fundamentally, the idea is that in the in the private world, so private reimbursement means that you're not Medicare, Medicaid, VA, or TRICARE. Okay, and so everybody who's left, that's the world that's covered by pretty much by private insurance. And a private insurer will develop a clinical network, and so they might come to us and say, okay, well, we'll pay you $50 to do an echocardiogram. I'm just making numbers up. And we agree to do that. So anybody who's followed by that insurer, if they show up on our doorstep for an echo, there's an agreement about what's going to be charged for that. But let's say that that we're out of network and somebody shows up from a different insurer that's not in our, we don't have a contract with. Well, then the insurer can say, hey, that's great that you're getting $50 for an echo from those other guys, but we're going to pay you $10. And so we accept the $10 from the insurer, and then the remainder, it's called a balance bill, goes to the patient. So as the patient, suddenly you're stuck with this big bill, and it's a surprise, and it's a not welcome surprise. And so this has been an issue as long as insurance companies have been around. And so there is a term of art called usual, customary, and reasonable. And the idea is, well, for somebody who's not covered by insurance, what is an appropriate payment? And so there used to be databases that would kind of sort out, well, what is the usual, customary, and reasonable payment for this service in this community? The last few databases were bought up in the 90s by United Healthcare, and pretty soon you've got a fox and hen house situation where they just announced that, well, instead of the reasonable payment for your community, well, we're just going to make up a number. And there were investigations in the early 2000s. The U.S. Senate investigated the healthcare insurance industry and pointed out that there were these fraudulent practices. United Healthcare was fined $400 million for this sort of stuff. Alaska was facing these same issues where there were insurance issues and patients upset with getting these giant balance bills. And so in Alaska, they came up with the 80th percentile rule, and there are a number of other states, most recently including Texas, that use this rule. And the idea is, well, if there are 80 providers providing this service, what do the bottom 80 charge for it? And that would be considered an appropriate rate in your community. And so, and that was kind of a backstop. Without that backstop, the insurers can just decide to pay you whatever they want. And so that backstop was removed by the Division of Insurance beginning in January 1st, 2024. And so there's the immediate problem, which is that patients are starting to get these balance bills. But the second problem, and the more important one, is that when an insurance company comes to our group and says, hey, we want to come up with terms for your contract for the next 5 years, instead of knowing that our background strategy is this 80th percentile, which at least would allow us to keep the lights on, they just say, well, and if you're not in the network, we'll pay you 150% of Medicare, which we know is not enough to stay in business in this state. And so as a consequence, a number of practices are closing. I personally just spent a half a day on the phone just trying to find an endocrinologist for my son, who's an adult with type 1 diabetes. And I thought, well, I'd have some inside track, but all the endocrinologists are either retiring or leaving, and no one's coming. And my kid, who's 25 years old, has a paying job after college, is back here in the state. He's going to have to keep going to Portland for his diabetes care. And it's not like diabetes is a super uncommon problem. And so so there are broader issues in terms of access to care it's not just a cost problem. So the 80th percentile issue is being addressed. The State Medical Association is addressing this two ways. I spent the morning watching a court hearing where the coalition of providers in the state is suing the Division of Insurance over inappropriately dropping that without appropriate consideration. We're looking to see if something can be reinstated. And then Senator Geisel is also introducing new legislation to have some kind of backstop for out of network care. So we're trying to solve it before, once Nordstrom's closed, it's hard to get it back up again. And we're trying to solve this before everybody leaves.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Carrick has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for that presentation, Dr. Compton. And you might not be the best person to answer this question, but I thought that the removal of the 80th percentile rule was a statutory change. And so I think you might have just answered the question, but is that what the challenge is coming from, was that should have happened through legislation?
Well, it was a statutory change. The Division of Insurance, it's a consumer protection that was initiated by the Murkowski administration in 2004. And the Division of Insurance abruptly dropped it, claiming that this specific rule is responsible for the for healthcare expenses increasing in the state of Alaska. We were able to show them data that clearly refutes that. The Division of Insurance based their decision, though, on two things. One was an inaccurate database called Fair Health. So they have numbers from this database, but if you look at the database, that same database will show you costs for getting heart surgery in Kodiak and Sitka. And many of you know that there's no heart surgery being performed in those communities, but the bottom line is it's an inaccurate database they're relying on. And number two, there is some federal legislation called the No Surprises Act, and the Division of Insurance in Alaska claimed that, well, with the No Surprises Act, we don't have to worry about balanced billing. The problem is that the No Surprises Act only applies to emergency care, and the vast majority of care people receive is non-emergent care.
Thank you.
So we are the lawsuit. The idea behind the lawsuit is that, well, a decision was made kind of arbitrarily without in the bases that were listed for the decision are both inaccurate. So we'll see where the court case goes, but in the meantime, we're also approaching it from a legislative standpoint. But that's far away, far afield from private equity. I'm sorry for the diversion there.
Okay. Thanks again, Dr. Compton, for being here. And next up in invited testimony is Dr. Marianne Folland. So, Dr. Folland, hopefully you can hear and see us, and go ahead and proceed with your testimony. And I think you might need to unmute on your end as well, Dr. Folland. We'll just take a brief at ease while we get Dr. Folland queued up. on the record and House.
I didn't know unmute was different than mute. Thank you. I'm Mary Ann Foland, and I'm a family doc in Anchorage at Primary Care Associates. And the State Medical Association asked me to speak to you because we have some experience with our company being bought out by a private equity firm in the past. And I just wanted to say that you really picked the best person to talk about the 80th percentile. So I thank Dr. Compton and his group for taking care of our patients and for helping us work through that. And it's a complicated thing, so thank you. But our group was bought out by a national group, and it was a company that mostly does work comp and urgent care, but not primary care. And then since then, we have been associated with OPA, Orthopedic Physicians of Anchorage, which is a physician-owned company. Now, all companies have to have a bottom line, but OPA is locally dedicated to the community and the patient care and employee wellness, and so that orientation has really been something that we can feel day to day. And as Dr. Compton explained, the metrics for a large, especially out-of-state company, is financially driven and not quality driven. And it ends up being great for the retiring docs who took that first bite of the apple and cashed out, but everybody else that's left just has to do more with less. And it's already hard enough to recruit new docs to Anchorage, not just endocrinologists. But what the companies find is that it's cheaper to replace a doc with a PA or a nurse practitioner. And there are a lot of national studies that show that a lesser trained and lesser experienced practitioners actually may be cheaper to hire but more expensive for the healthcare system because of ordering more tests, the less training that you have. And there are studies that we can review for that. I wanted to give a couple examples because a friend of ours who was a doc who worked in our practice went back home to Orlando to be near a family member who was ill, and she had practiced there. She's my age, so she's practiced for decades. And there she found out that most of the private practices had been bought out by bigger companies, and they had 10 to 15 minutes to see each patient, 6 to 10 with the patient, and 4 to 5 with the chart. Next, please. So even high-risk patients with congestive heart failure or renal failure or behavioral health, psych issues, it just isn't enough to really give the patient what they need. There's another friend of mine who was a surgeon, subspecialist working for a big organization, and after being there for a while, found that they didn't have enough nurses or nurse practitioners or medical assistants even to help check the patients in, so the surgeons had to check the patients in, get their vital signs, and then take care of the patient, and that they had a quota. So even when they were required to travel for work to like a remote area, the quota kept ticking away, and then when they came back to Anchorage, they had to catch up to meet their quota and felt that, you know, they just weren't having time to really take care of their patients. And so that practitioner retired early. So my concern is that if this is a trend, who's going to be there for us and our families when we need to go to the emergency room or, God forbid, go to a nursing home? I don't think there are going to be many physicians doing that. So I, for one, am proud to be part of a local physician-led patient care team. We employ in our group and greatly appreciate our collaboration with the physician assistants and the nurse practitioners that work with us. But we work as part of a physician-led care team, and I really think that that is the best way to go. And I think that we're allowed to do that here working for OPA, and we were not allowed to do that as much when we were part of the bigger company. So I think this is better for us and better for our patients to be really hesitant about large private equity firms coming into Alaska.
Thanks, Dr. Follen. Do members have questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Follen, I'd be interested to know what the data you have, if you can provide to the committee information on the ultimate higher costs of hiring paraprofessionals instead of full physicians. That's an intriguing dynamic, and I'd just like to see some documentation of that if you have any available.
I can look that up. I know that there, for the last several years, there have been studies that come out through the AMA to look at that, and I will be glad to get that to you, and I'll talk to Evan about how to get that to you guys.
Okay. Not seeing further questions, we do have one additional testifier on this bill who is in clinic right now, and she's going to call us on her way to pick up her kids from school later if the timing works out, so we may return to this topic. But for now, our next order of business is House Bill. Thank you, Dr. Fullen and Dr. Compton, for being here.
Sure.
Our next order of business. Oh, sorry.
You're welcome.
Dr. Fullen, sorry, Representative Sadler has a question.
No, sir. It's actually, if you made reference to this bill. I'm not sure if this testimony is in support of a particular bill or just
No. Sorry, misunderstanding. Okay. And actually, you know what? Our final testifier, I think, just called in. So let's just wrap up this item. Dr. Carlson Constantino, if you're online, go ahead and proceed with your testimony. Let's take a brief at ease and see if we can get the final testifier in this, I meant hearing. On the record, just seeing if Dr. Meg Carlson Constantino is ready to start her testimony. Dr. Carlson, can you hear us? Okay, tell you what, we will return to Dr. Carlson. The next item on our agenda is House Bill 23 by Representative Josephson. Representative Josephson, thanks for being here. Thanks also to Representative Gray, who got here a few minutes ago. Members should have a proposed committee substitute for House Bill 23 in their binders. So, Madam Co-Chair, do you have a motion to bring the CS before the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt the proposed committee substitute for House Bill 23, Work Draft 34-LS0249/I, as a working document.
Okay, Representative Sadler has an objection. Representative Josephson and staff, do you want to come up and perhaps share what's in the CS?
Yes.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Okay, Representative Sadler has a question.
No, actually, we had not for the public announced what the short title of HB 23 or the work draft, so if for public acceptance of what we're doing here on the table, it'd be nice to know what the bill is about.
Yes, legislation on the State Commission on Human Rights. Thank you, Representative
Sadler.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Josephson, could you just perhaps describe the CS that has been moved?
Yes. I'm Andy Josephson, House District 13, and in Anchorage. With me is my staff, Ken Alper. This CS expands the bill so that if you look at the document marked Applicability to the Last State Commission, a summary of changes, it appears that number 5 is the same, essentially, and the other parts are part of bills that had been introduced by Representative Prox and Representative Vance in the previous legislature. Those change the name of the commission to the Commission for Civil Rights. They add a requirement that commissioners could not be removed except for just cause. They change the timing and method of the commission's annual report. They clarify that a discrimination claim cannot be brought against a religious organization if the employee is hired for religious purpose. And that's essentially those changes.
Okay. Do members have questions for Representative Josephson or his staff? Representative Garrick.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Josephson. On the summary of changes, it says changes the timing and method of the annual report. Can you just describe what those changes are?
I think that I'm going to defer to Mr. Alper on that.
Thank you. For the record, Ken Alper, staff to Representative Josephson, and through the chair to Representative Carrick. That is in the Section 3 of the committee substitute. It's on the middle of second page. Currently, there's a requirement for an annual report to be made available through the Legislative Affairs Agency with 40 paper copies and a timing that it show up in the week before the convening of an annual legislative session. The two real changes are that no longer requiring the physical paper copies that it could be delivered electronically and pushing back the annual deadline to November 15th. That's what was recommended to us by the commission. I don't have any insight as to why, but the practicality of no longer needing the paper copies in today's environment makes certain intuitive sense to me. And Mr. Chairman, I believe the executive director is available for questions as well.
Okay. Further questions for Representative Josephson, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Josephson, at the last time you had HB 23 before us, I had asked the question of their mostly these changes had not been in your initial version. Mm-hmm. Just curious, what was your thought process in going from the initial, I'll say, pretty stripped down version of this bill to the deluxe version?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, what was unusual about this process is that I didn't have any objection to any of it. It all seemed acceptable. And I would have, in the last term, would have supported Representative Prox's bill and would have supported Representative Vance's bill. So I saw these as helpful. And there's language in Section 4 that clarifies that the folks subject to the jurisdiction would not be a religious organization. This was important because, for example, Providence Hospital is one of the larger employers in the state, and it is a Catholic hospital, I guess. I don't think of it that way when I go for treatment there, but that's what it is. But to the extent employees are not working in a religious sort of capacity, they would be subject to the jurisdiction. So I viewed this as protecting First Amendment free exercise rights and also employees' rights against discrimination. So just to summarize, I would look at another bill and say, well, I got to take parts, but I don't like it all. But I couldn't find any reason not to ask that you all adopt all these other measures.
Representative Coloman, I apologize for skipping you.
That's okay. Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, do the changes change the fiscal note, or is it still a zero fiscal note? Or
through the chair, Representative Colomb, I'm thinking of burdens on the state here. It may be that we would have to ask. So I don't think I've seen a fiscal note yet this year. So we'd have to look at last year's version. I suspect there's going to be. Invariably, there would be more cases. So we would want to ask Mr. Corbusier about impacts on his agency principally, I would think.
Thank you. And Mr. Corbusier is showing unavailable on Teams at the moment. He had attempted to call in. There he is. Go ahead, Mr. Corbusier. Thank you.
I have to have limited it, so I switched to my phone. Chair, this will still be a zero fiscal note. The only reason he's going to finance is we need a little some additional receipt authority for the increase in federal receipts for the paying of case and co-jurisdictional U.S. use.
Okay, for members who may not have been out here because it's a little bit of a rough connection, Mr. Corbusier was saying there will continue to be a zero fiscal note, and the only reason it's going to finance is for increased receipt authority. So there is a motion to adopt the CS and an objection. Are there further questions? Representative Sadler.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. If we have the larger bill before us, I do anticipate some discussion. So I have some questions for the sponsor of the bill. First, if you could repeat for us that the reason for the naming of this of the commission is a slight change. What's the driver behind that slight edit?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the slight edit is that I had members of the board, commissioners, and their director who's on the phone with us in my office, and they made a case, Mr. Alper was with me at the time, that, for example, they get calls from prisoners who are making what they believe are human rights claims, and they have to be polite, which is a good thing in our society, but they have to sort of steer these folks to some other office or authority, or just simply say, we don't have the jurisdiction. They submit that this is a better reflection of their obligations. And if there was any section on this, by the way, that gave me a little hesitancy, this was it, because of the historic title, Human Rights Commission. But they also noted that most states, I think, Mr. Alper would correct me if I'm wrong, call their agencies civil rights commissions. And that's their final comment was, that's what they do. It's really about civil rights.
Through the chair?
Yes.
Through the chair, Mr. Representative Joseph, what is the distinction between a human right and a civil right? And I guess the question is, does this renaming have any, does it change the applicability or the authority or the reach of this commission?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the things that are illegal under the human rights law as it exists are discrimination based on employment, place of public accommodation, sale or rental of real property, financing, credit, and practices by a state or a political subdivision. When I think of human rights, I guess those are a subset of human rights, but I think of human rights as something that the late Jimmy Carter might be interested in, where you're looking at a persecution of someone, sort of an Amnesty International context, and those things just don't apply.
So
go ahead, Representative Sadler.
I appreciate that, but that doesn't quite answer my question: as the distinction between human rights, which you went on at length about, versus civil rights, and does the changing it to civil rights change this commission's applicability or authority?
Representative Sadler, why don't we go to Mr. Corbusier, who asked for this, and he can explain whether there's a difference and why they're asking
to him. That'd be
for
great.
It. Do you want to do that?
Mr. Chairman, the representative asked if I want to devolve proper usage, perfect word, the authority. It's not really mine. I would tell you that there's nothing in the bill that changes substantively anything that they do. Nothing. Except obviously, as to jurisdiction over nonprofits. But if Mr. Corbusier wants to clarify, that's great.
Yeah, do you have anything you want to add, Mr. Corbusier, about changing the term human to civil?
Yeah, absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. The provisional article in Section 3 of the Constitution that we enforce that mandates Asher's existence is titled Civil Rights. And we see this as more accurately reflecting what the agency actually does. And so it'll cut down on frivolous calls wanting us to take a position on human rights violations in a foreign war, or wanting us to take a position on environmental causes, because isn't it a human right to have clean air and clean water, that kind of thing. This does not change our jurisdiction at all. We, if anything, the term human rights is a more encompassing term when you look at things like the UN Declaration on Human Rights. And it's split amongst the states. You know, it's about 50-50 where it's like civil rights, equal rights versus human rights. And even during the civil rights era, there were debates as to what should be the proper term, and it was just kind of a mixed bag.
Very good. Thank you. Further questions?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the second change adds a requirement the governor can only remove a commissioner for cause. That's a fairly significant change in the authority of the governor to manage the members of the boards and commissions under his purview. Do you know how many other boards establish this higher standard of removal only for cause, and why does this commission deserve that level of higher threshold?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I'm about to recommend that Mr. Corbusier answer this. However, we did get, I think, an opinion. Yes. And I'll let Mr. Alper speak to it. At the end, I think he's going to note that it's a quasi-judicial body, but I'll see what Mr. Alper can share.
thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair to Representative Sadler. We do, in fact, have a memo in hand that we will happily provide to the committee from Allison Radford at Legislative Legal. And Representative Josephson is correct. This is a regulatory or quasi-judicial agency, which means it's within the universe of things that can be made subject to being removed for cause. We don't have before us a comprehensive list of which agencies are in that category, but the question we had asked and which was answered was, can we legally do that for this commission? And we were told yes, we could, because of their regulatory role. I believe we have a follow-up question that we don't have in hand yet about which current boards and commissions are in the for cause versus at the will of the governor category, and that was devolved from legal to ledge research, and we're waiting to hear back from them.
I will read that memo with interest.
Mr. Chairman, it's possible that Mr. Corbusier could give us more explanation to that item.
Sure, go ahead, Mr. Corbusier.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I have no idea how many other quasi-judicial agencies have a for-cause removal provision. I can tell you kind of the history as to why the commission asked for this. The original resolution was a request of Commissioner William Craig, who is a blind Clinkett commissioner from Sitka. When he started, this predates my time on the commission, there was a commissioner that had just checked out that staff could not get a hold of. Nobody knew where this person had gone for approximately a year. And there was no obvious path for removing this commissioner. I mean, it's not that other commissioners have any ability to remove a fellow commissioner, nor can staff remove a commissioner, obviously. So it was like, well, what do we do with this kind of derelict? And then, you know, moving forward from that, the commissioners thought that the governor should have an explicit, articulated tool to remove a commissioner, rather than just leaving it to question or to. There's an argument that it is not an at will. If you look at the case Bradner v. Hammond, that was a situation where there was a commissioner removal at issue. Now, the counter argument as to why that wouldn't apply to the Human Rights Commission is because in Bradner v. Hammond, it was a paid commission seat as opposed to the Asher commissioners, who were all volunteers. But we also did a deep dive in our own legislative history, and we just don't think that the legislature ever contemplated, when they set up a quasi-judicial body in five-year rotating seats back in 1963, that there would ever need to be a time when a commissioner would need to be removed from the seat. And there have been times since then the governor has removed commissioners. And to avoid the commission becoming, you know, potentially a political sword or a political shield for a particular administration's desires, the commission thought that to maintain our apolitical nature in terms of our cases and case enforcement and direction to me and the other staff, that having a commissioner removal tool that was for cause would ensure that the agency's substantive work would remain apolitical. Okay. The commission was also very cognizant of the fact that they are all appointees of the current governor. And so, you know, they would be, in theory, the beneficiaries of this, and it wouldn't impact all the future administrations. So this was certainly not meant by them to be a thumb in the eye of the governor.
And last observation, thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. So just to be clear, so currently the governor does have the authority to remove a Human Rights Commissioner for any reason or no reason. Is that correct? There is actually a method for that to happen, correct?
Through the chair, I think there is an argument. So there's a statute that says, if a commission does not have an explicit for-cause removal provision or something like that, and I can't quote you the statute, but they are at will, and the governor can remove anybody for any reason. I think there is an argument to be made that Asher was not intended to fall within that statute, also in part because Asher predates that statute. Like I said, the counter argument, and then the support would come from Bradner v. Hammond. The counter argument to that is, well, Bradner v. Hammond involved a property right because that commissioner was being paid. it would require, you know, to get a judicial determination on this, a removed commissioner would need to challenge the governor's decision. And there isn't necessarily an incentive for commissioners to do that by filing a Superior Court lawsuit because they have no money at stake in this.
Okay. So I think my assertion was correct. So good. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, after some very robust discussion, is the objection maintained?
I will maintain my objection. Yes, sir.
Okay. Great. Does anyone else have commentary on this before we vote on adopting the committee substitute? Again, this is the committee substitute recommended by the State Human Rights Commission. Okay. Seeing none, Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Representative Berg.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Colomb?
Yes.
Co-Chair Hall?
Yes.
Co-Chair Fields?
Yes.
Six yeas, one nay.
Okay, so with six yeas and one nay, the CS is adopted. I'm guessing there are not further questions on this bill at this time. Therefore, that concludes our hearing on HB 23. The amendment deadline for this bill is 4 p.m. on Tuesday, February 25th. Please draft the amendments to the committee substitute. So,
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Just to clarify, tomorrow, 4 p.m. tomorrow?
Yes, sir. Yep.
That's not a lot of time, sir.
Tell you what, if you are running out of time, let me know, and we can adjust. Yeah, just stay in touch if that's insufficient time. Next up is House Bill 34 from Representative Holland. So we have heard this bill twice before, and members should have received a committee substitute and have it in their binders for review. Madam Co-Chair, would you like to move the CS?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt the proposed committee substitute for House Bill 34, Work Draft 34-LS0353/G, as a working document.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion and let Representative Holland's staff describe the CS, and I believe Representative Holland is also on the phone. No, okay. My misunderstanding. Go ahead, Mr. Ebersolden, describe the CS, please.
For the record, Cameron Ebersold, staff to Representative Kai Holland. This new proposed CS of the bill incorporates a lot of the feedback we heard from committee members in the previous two hearings. The most substantive of these changes is the reduction of the overall size of the council from 19 to 15 members. In the committee members should have received an explanation of all those changes, including which members have been eliminated. And that is largely the most substantive of the changes, although there's a few others, including now as part of their annual report, a requirement to look into capital markets and make an assessment of where gaps exist in Alaska's capital markets. If members have other questions,
Thank you. Do members have questions for Mr. Ebersold? Representative Colomb.
Yeah, so this added membership, one member of the council is required to have an association with an organized labor group. The intent of this was trying to get that innovator to get connected to financial support. Why would we need a labor group?
Through the chair to Representative Colomb, this was again incorporating some feedback we had heard from committee members. As for example, the access to skilled labor is an important part of a growing, thriving economy, and that was something that some committee members had requested to see. So
kind of follow up. It just seems like it's a little outside the scope of what you guys presented the Innovation Council to be. I thought, like, my picture was that you have innovators that need help and resources to kind of get off the ground, that the Small Business Development Center couldn't help because this was a step behind that. Now we're already talking about laborers. So I'm just, it seems like it's expanded its scope a little more than I had first understood.
Representative Plum, I can give just one example about where that seat could come into play. So in some of the areas of the economy where you have growing dispatch through digital devices, mm-hmm. This hasn't happened in Alaska, but in other states, labor organizations have worked with companies like Lyft to make benefit packages available to non-employee workers, i.e. independent contractors. So as we have a changing labor market, that is one area where, you know, access to benefits might be an option in addition to training.
Yeah, I guess I just, if I may, I guess my understanding of the purpose of this council, I see what you're saying. That feels kind of far down the path. This is trying to get innovators, you know, going, but that's fine. I had one other question.
Of course.
Changes. So you also, I think this is a change that the council will now annually elect a chair who serves one term. I'm not sure what it was before, but why one term? Because it seems like it's hard to do anything in 1 year. Why not two?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne, the term is 1 year, but they actually may serve for up to three terms. So the individual chair could be could hold that for three consecutive years, theoretically. Mm-hmm. And additionally, the purpose of this council is to create a series of recommendations. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible that, for example, the chair is more intended to, I think, just shepherd the other members of the committee as they move through which recommendations they want to pursue. So,
all right, thanks.
All good. Okay, Representative Nelson and then Carrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, so the council, you know, having a series of recommendations, you know, I appreciate the representative lowering the number from 19 to 15, or trying to. What's the updated fiscal note on having 15 members?
Through the chair to Representative Nelson, I do not believe a new fiscal note has been created for this new CS yet, mm-hmm. but as soon as it is available, I'm sure the committee will be made to access it. So
no ballpark, because it was at what, $500,000 mm-hmm. Per year.
Let's take a brief at ease. Wanted to speak to, is there an updated fiscal note, or will there be one, or is it not changing? Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Hannah Lager. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Through the chair, Representative, we have not yet prepared a new fiscal note. We will do that after the committee substitute is adopted.
Do you have a ballpark of what that would be? Because it was $500,000 previously at the 19 members, correct?
Through the chair to the representative, that is about the ballpark. I don't have an updated estimate, but I do expect that it will be a little bit lower given that there are fewer members. That's less travel.
Okay. So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair, it might still be a question for Anna, potentially. What are the positions that we took away from the original draft?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, do you, when you say positions, you mean the members of the council?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I see that we had before five members appointed by the governor who are experienced entrepreneurs. Did we reduce that number? Were there the two members from UA are still there? So just asking which members did we reduce?
Understood. Okay. Through the chair to Representative Carrick, the governor or their direct designees is no longer the commissioner of revenue. The executive director of the Permanent Fund Corporation, and the originally introduced version had two members each from the Senate and House of Representatives. That is now one each. So those that's a reduction of one, two, five right there.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Representative Sadler. Oh, sorry. Are you done, Representative Kerrick, or follow-up? Okay. Representative Sadler.
Yeah, I do apologize. My binder is a bit confusing. I think there is a summary of changes that were made. I simply cannot put my hands on it. So, Evan, if possible, to get a copy of changes.
I have mine.
Sure. Let's take a brief at ease, and we'll give Representative Sadler.
Yep. Oh, found it.
Oh,
Barry.
Okay.
Nope. Apologies. Got it.
All good. Okay.
Yep.
Is there further discussion on adopting this CS? Okay, I guess I will withdraw my objection. Is there further objection to adopting the CS? Seeing no objection, that CS is adopted. So this bill will also have an amendment deadline for 4 p.m. Tuesday, February 25th. If you have requested an amendment and not gotten it back and we need to extend that, just let me know.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, having two bills here up, it's now 4:15, giving us 24 hours to review a new CS of these two bills, to go to drafting and get amendments drafted. I believe that is too fast and not a very, considered window of opportunity to provide amendments to these bills.
Okay. Hey, no problem. Why don't we set this one for 4 p.m. Thursday, February 25th, and leave the other one as is to spread that workload out.
Thank you, sir.
You bet. And that concludes this hearing on House Bill 34. And now we are going to go back to our final invited testifier, who was in clinic on private equity and healthcare. So, Dr. Carlson Constantino, thanks for being here and sharing with the committee today.
Thank you. Sorry for running a little late.
You're good.
Okay. So I'm here. I represent the Alaska Academy of Family Physicians. And we represent for 340 family physicians in the state of Alaska. I'm here to talk today about, I think, some of the national data that was distributed to you and the committee. This comes from our National Academy of Family Physicians, which is our national organization representing over 120,000 members nationwide. And for those of you who don't know what family medicine is, we are physicians that make up majority of your primary care in Alaska. We are accountable for addressing majority of personal health care needs, mostly sustaining like long-term partnership with whole families that we see in our practice, and really, you know, take into account the whole breadth of the community and family in what we do. This is really person-centered, community-aligned, and we take pride in the fact that we deliver that care and provide it at the lower cost. Like all physicians, we do best when we serve our patients, and we don't serve the interests of institutions or corporations that do not have patient interest in mind. For primary care physicians nationwide, we've started to see a startling trend that is even starting to hit Alaska, where we're seeing many private practices go under and turn into consolidated corporate entities. This loss is really tragic. It's a tragic loss for the community when this happens, because this also consolidation method leads to just higher prices for our patients, that leads to also higher insurance premiums on average, as well as quality of care metrics actually do not improve when we consolidate. They actually decrease. Family medicine is one of the few specialties that can lead to lower cost, but that doesn't happen when we're consolidated, because consolidated practices tend to increase the quantity of visits, not the quality of visits, as well as they increase a referral system that incentivizes you referring to more lucrative practices and not taking care of everything in-house because of cost. So to help our Alaskan communities, I would really encourage that we think about trying to help our independent practices stay open, so that we help keep healthcare costs down that we already know are high in our state, and then we help overall the care of our communities.
Do members have questions for Dr. Carlson Constantino? Representative Colum.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, thank you for testifying. I wanted to swing back to what you said, that that we need to help independent practices stay open. What do you think the role of state government is in supporting independent practices?
And I know a lot of this is definitely, there's higher things that are federal. I know a lot of independent practices, especially in primary care, have struggled with just a lot of complexities. Like red tape, honestly, is a big problem that we see in private practices on one of their main reasons why they can't handle the amount of like prior authorizations that they're getting. They have to hire more people to take care of things like that. So a lot of red tape. We even see that, honestly, from Medicaid, though. So state-based things could change to improve that. But I also thinking making sure that we're disincentivizing like corporate, as I said, that the consolidation of medicine is really that idea of giving people really only one choice in the future. And so making those practices and not allowing private equity to come in, but honestly, even trying to make sure that hospitals don't just take over every small practice too, which I know in state-based can be hard, but there are definitely some things that could be done to prevent that.
And Dr. Carlson Constantino, I was hoping that you could elaborate on how when private equity takes over a practice, they can maximize profit at the expense of the state by ordering unnecessary tests, for example. Could you just walk us through that risk?
Yep. How I talked about like how a lot of times there is that incentive to referrals to or to order more testing that brings in more revenue. Also, so kind of exploiting the system. Most of the time, that's not something most independent practices are doing, but it's a rewarded because corporate entities care about profits at the end of the day. They're not putting those profits back into the community. Like we see independent practices, physician-owned practices, usually reinvest money into the community. We don't see reinvestment from private equity in our communities.
Thank you. Are there further questions for Dr. Carlson? Thank you very much. Really appreciate you being here today to share your perspective and also working your schedule and testimony with your schedule in the clinic. So thank you. I think we have one more testifier, Dr. Papakostas. Hopefully Dr. Papakostas can hear us. If so, Dr. Papakostas, go ahead with your testimony. Let's take a brief at ease and see if we can get the technology working. Sorry for the delays. Okay, back on the record. Thank you, Dr. Papakostas, for being here, and please proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you so much, Representative Fields and members of the committee, for talking about this important issue. I am Nick Papakostas. I'm an ER doctor in Anchorage, and I'm affiliated with a state organization called the Alaska Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, which has emergency physicians, you know, across the state, and we have board members kind of in every kind of major emergency department in the state. I personally lived in Alaska 11 years now. I came up initially with the Air Force and was active duty on the J-Bear in Anchorage, and then transitioned into full-time work at Providence Alaska Medical Center with the group there called Alaska Emergency Medical Associates. You know, private equity in healthcare is definitely a relatively new phenomenon and fast-growing. It is a huge increase since 2000 and like a 20-fold increase since the year 2000. With 70% of the increase happening since the year 2010. And private equity offers very differently from other sort of investment strategies. Usually these are small kind of groups with, you know, large institutional investors and very high net worth individuals that can invest in these funds. And really their job is to maximize the amount of revenue they can generate. And really their goal is to kind of acquire a business and make a profit and then sell it at a profit for 3 to 6 years. So they are not a long-term mindset kind of operation. So when they come in and they come in and acquire either a hospital or a physician group, they try to grow their margins to meet their new financial obligations. Because a lot of times when they buy out these practices or hospitals, they do so with borrowed money. Something like 60 to 80% of the funds they use to buy their hospital or physician group can be totally leveraged. In other words, you know, totally financed with debt. And then they try to flip it. And they are relatively insulated with the law's work from their kind of bad debt. So what they come in and often do is they try to raise the revenue in a place it's generating. So staffing cuts is employed, decreased investment in the equipment purchased or postponing maintenance on existing equipment. And also sort of they try to cycle through new physicians, new APPs that usually are less experienced and tend to burn them out and then try to hire new ones. It is definitely a problem. Private equity forces does not operate very much in Alaska as of yet. And the main kind of guardrail, I think, around that so far has been the reimbursement environment has been fairly favorable, you know, for physicians in a way, in the sense that the insurance companies that want with bad behavior have not been able to drive down costs. So there is some kind of question about what's going to happen around that with the 80 percentile having been repealed last year. I know there's some like discussion about what's going to happen at the state level, but that is something that physicians are watching and worried about because, you know, with areas where there's not, you know, fake reimbursement and high amount of people that are in government insurance, that is where private equity tends to get their hooks in. If physician practices start to struggle and they're having trouble keeping their lights on, that is when they're vulnerable to buyout to private equity firms, because it basically feels like a lifeline coming in to these, you know, smaller groups that are, you know, struggling. It's like, oh my gosh, we weren't able to keep the lights on. And they're, you know, at first kind of grateful. And I think they see what happens to their practice afterwards. And some of them maybe feel like they don't have a choice. I think what I'll do is I'll share an article with the committee through, you know, Representative Field's office that from the American College of Emergency Physicians that kind of discussed this in detail, you know, with references. A separate topic is kind of vertical integration with healthcare, which I think Dr. Costantino was talking about, is that as, you know, there's more vertical integration, there is more kind of referral internally, both from pharmacy standpoints and hospital or surgical procedures. And I can share an article that was published on that in 2023 as well for the committee.
Great.
And I guess if there's any questions about this, I'm happy to try to answer as best as I can.
Are there questions for Dr. Papakostas? Thank you, Dr. Papakostas, for being here and to the other testifiers for helping us understand what's going on in a pretty complex market landscape. That completes our business. So we will next convene Wednesday, February 26th at 3:15. Seeing no further business before the committee, we're adjourned at 4:27.